This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. They might not ever volunteer any information, but when we take the time to ask a few questions, we learn just how much they've done for us. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. Along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, we're inspired, and we are in for a treat today. Every one of these interviews feels like a privilege for me, but this one is pretty unique. I was invited by Clovis North High School in Clovis, California, to come onto the campus, sit up on stage in the beautiful Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall with legendary conductor Colonel Arnold Gabriel, and in front of a big group of teenagers who are studying music and history, interview this D-Day survivor turned military music icon. You'll find some photos and links to information about Colonel Gabriel at hometownheroesradio.com. If you followed the National Memorial Day Parade in Washington, D.C., maybe you noticed he was the Grand Marshal, fresh off receiving the Air Force Exceptional Service Award at the National Memorial Day Concert, which was held at the Kennedy Center. All this excitement is taking place in 2015, but to start our conversation, we've got to go way back to long before any of those teenagers in our captive audience were born, and long before their parents were born, for that matter.
I know it's a few years ago, but can you take us back to long before you thought about being a colonel or a major or a captain or anything like that, but growing up in central New York? Tell us about your hometown and what life was like before World War II.
Well, it was pretty grim, really. My mom and dad were born in Italy and came to this country with a second-grade education. They got married in Brooklyn, New York, and moved upstate to Cortland, New York. But it was pretty grim because it was during the Depression. And, of course, it was two strikes because not only were everybody in the country was poor because of the Depression in the 30s, but also because I lived in an Italian community, we were discriminated against because we were, quote, foreigners. So it was very difficult. My dad worked on the railroad for 75 cents a day, and I remember my older brother and me and my mom and dad splitting a can of beans for dinner. That's how poor things were in those days.
Wow. And how big was your family?
Well, eventually I had two brothers, but when we were in the 30s, there were just me and my older brother. My younger brother was born in 1940.
Now, anyone who knows who you are now or even meets you now, it would be hard for them to see you outside of the realm of music. That's how you're identified in our country and in the world for good reason. But where did that start? How early on did you start to develop this love for music?
I was about 10 or 11 years old, and my dad loved opera. And right around the corner, there was a Catholic church, and there was a touring company from Syracuse, New York, that was doing Cavalleria Rusticana, the opera. And so I'm a 10, 11-year-old kid, and it was very meager. I think they had a piano and about three woodwinds and about two or three strings, and the sets were very minimal. But when they did the intermezzo from Cavalleria Rusticana, I was taken. To this day, it's my favorite 48 measures of music. And so it was that incident that really hooked me on music and said, I need to be a musician.
And I'm glad you said it that way. Did you hear him say 48 measures of music? I've heard that this gentleman could thumb through an arrangement that has note after note after note, thousands, and say, hey, wait a second, on page 35 in measure XYZ at this note, that's supposed to be actually a C major. Is that true? Can you actually kind of... Do you have that photographic or encyclopedic memory of the notes, and then you see it on paper and you know it doesn't add up?
No, it's really just hard work. Mm-hmm. I don't have a photographic memory, but my IQ is about 125, which is pretty average, and it's just plain hard work, and it's something I've always wanted to do. Because I have those of you who are musicians can appreciate this comment. A conductor should have the score in his head, not his head in the score.
That's a good one. Short but to the point. Let's remember that. All these young people, I mean, we're looking out here at 16, 17, maybe 18-year-olds, and they're looking at you and say, oh, that guy might be 70, 75. Why don't you tell them all how old you are?
90 years old.
How about that? A again, going back to that young boy, you discover this opera. And, you know, it's funny. You and I were just talking about some upstate New York connections. I went to school at Syracuse University. You went to Ithaca College, just a few miles away. And the first time I visited Syracuse, the dean of the communication school took me into his office, and he had to turn down his radio because he was playing the Metropolitan Opera out of New York City. And I understand that was your pastime, huh?
Right, exactly. Every Saturday afternoon, the Texaco Star Theater was broadcast from the Metropolitan Opera. And my dad would sing along in his crackety old Italian voice and some of the arias. But yes, every Saturday, that was a ritual.
Well, and I've got to ask you, if you fell in love with the opera that way, did you ever dream of being one of these great tenors that we hear of legendarily, like Pavarotti and now Domingo and some of these greats?
Well, my dad wanted to be a tenor because his hero was Enrico Caruso.
Uh-huh.
But to be a singer, you have to be born with a voice. And I don't have a voice, unfortunately. You wouldn't want to hear me sing.
You guys want to hear him sing, right?
No,
I won't do that to you. What was your first instrument?
First was a flute.
You did that in high school?
I did.
But something happened while you were going to high school. I think it's important to talk about that, because I have not yet met a veteran yet, and I've interviewed hundreds of veterans, who does not have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you found out that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor?
Precisely. It was a Sunday afternoon. My friend and I went to a movie, and I regret to say this, we went to a pool hall, and it was there we had found out that we were at war with Japan, that they had bombed Pearl Harbor. I remember that very clearly. And I was a boy then of 15 years old in 1941, and I thought, 15 years old, I'm never going to get in. It'll be over long before I get in. And didn't realize that 3 years later I was going to be in the Army, and 9 months later I was on the beach of Normandy landing with the 29th Infantry Division.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And I want to take you back to something you said a moment ago, too. You talked about growing up there in Cortland, New York, that your family felt discrimination because you were Italian immigrants. Mm-hmm. Your parents had come over. You were born here. And then, by the time you got into World War II, America was at war with Italy also. And in fact, a lot of Americans of Italian descent weren't allowed to go to the European theater because basically the government didn't trust their loyalty. Mm-hmm. Was that something you were aware of at the time?
Yes, I was aware of that. And I think there's something that not even many adults are aware of. They're aware of the camps that we had for the Japanese here on the West Coast, but there were also camps of Italians.
Yes.
That weren't allowed to do anything except stay in those camps until the war was over.
But that didn't happen where you were?
Not in upstate New York, No.
Tell me how you ended up in the service. Did you wait until Uncle Sam said, you have to come, you were drafted, or did you decide to enlist before that happened?
No, I enlisted May 31. I was 18 years old. I graduated high school 2 weeks later, and 6 days later, I enlisted in the Army. So I had just turned 18 and didn't realize a year later, on May 31, I had just turned 19, and 6 days later, I was on the beach of Normandy.
Yeah.
It all happened that fast.
So some of you in here are 18, I'm sure, right? Can you imagine a year from now going ashore on one of the bloodiest beaches that has ever been seen in the history of war? That's what this gentleman experienced. And you didn't just experience being there. A lot of people can say, I was part of the Normandy invasion. The outfit that you were with, the 29th Infantry Division, more specifically the 116th Infantry Regiment,
right,
saw some of the worst of Omaha Beach. Before we get to that, because I think all you guys here, all you students have heard about D-Day, right? You've heard that phrase, D-Day. You've seen some of the pictures. But you don't know what's going to happen before it happens, right? What do you remember about the buildup to that invasion? Were you anticipating something like this? Was this a surprise to you? Can you give us a glimpse of what the weeks or months leading up to D-Day were like?
No, we had planned for an invasion of France. We didn't know precisely where it was going to be, whether it was going to be Calais. Even the Germans were trying to guess where we were going to land. So we had practiced for months about landing on a beach. It was called Slapton Sands in England,
yeah,
which was similar to the beaches of northern France. So we knew that the day would be coming.
Before D-Day, there was a legendary tragedy at Slapton Sands, an Operation Tiger. It was a training exercise, but
right,
the Germans showed up right off the coast in U-boats,
right,
and started gunning down the Americans and the British. You weren't there for that, were you?
That was just north of us. That was the 28th Division from Pennsylvania. And if you knew what the symbol of Pennsylvania is, it's like a bucket. But that's what they wore on their shoulder.
Right.
And it was red. And one of the German subs hit one of the landing craft of the 28th Division. And so from that day forward, we call them the Bloody Bucket Division. But, you know, the kind of gallows humor, you have to keep a sense of humor. We had a guy join us when we were in St. Lo. St. Lo is a city inland. We were supposed to take it D plus 7 days. It was D plus 45. That's how rough it was going inland. And when we finally got there, I was joined with my machine gun squad by a fellow that had been in the 82nd Airborne. And I said, what are you doing here with the 29th Division? He said, well, I don't want to jump anymore because I jumped with my brother on D-Day, and he left his boot on the beach, and his foot was in it. Not funny, but kind of gallows humor that keeps you alive in combat.
Well, and that hits home. And your division, the 29th, was decimated on D-Day. In fact, last year on the 70th anniversary of June 6, 44, you were back at Normandy conducting this huge band on the 70th anniversary. Tell us where you're going to be on the 71st anniversary.
Well, you mentioned the 116th Regiment. A company of the 116th was from, being a National Guard, everybody was from the same city. And A company was from Bedford, Virginia, and they were the spearhead. And on the very first day of D-Day, 24 of them were killed. And before we left Normandy, 44 were killed from that tiny village of Bedford, Virginia. So that's where they built the D-Day Memorial. So on June 6th this year, I'm going to be there. They've asked me to conduct my old division band, the 29th Infantry Division Band, at the D-Day Memorial in Bedford, Virginia. So that'll be very emotional.
That's incredible. And I could tell it's emotional just talking about it for you right here. But for you students, can you imagine that? 24 people from the same hometown on the first day of the invasion and 44 throughout that battle. Imagine that 24 people from this room are just gone like that. And they were about your age when this happened. So that was part of your division and, in fact, part of your regiment. You were talking about what the Bloody Bucket Division wore on their arms. So you had the blue and gray, right?
The blue and gray, the north and the south, because it was National Guard from Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. So they were both the North and the South were involved in the National Guard with the 29th Division.
And you were part of a machine gun squad?
Yes, 30 caliber light machine gun.
I know that day is not easy to talk about, and I know that music is something that helped you heal from some of the scars that your whole experience in the war left you with. But what do you remember about that day? It's been called the longest day. It's certainly a day that changed the world. But from your perspective, from the time you hit the beach to the end of that day, what are some of the things that you did and experienced?
Well, it was fear, confusion, fright, a little bit of everything. Nobody landed where they were supposed to. Not the 82nd Airborne, who jumped before we hit the beach. We hit the beach way left of where we were supposed to, and I ended up with the 1st Division, which was on our left flank. I was then with the 116th Easy Company, and I said, I've got to get back to the 29th Division. And so total confusion. I didn't have my machine gun because I left that in the water. The water was up to my waist. And most of us, either that deep or some have never made it drown before they got to the beach. But anyway, so I made my way back to the 29th and ended up with I Company, the 175th. And they said, we need a machine gunner. You're going to be with us now. I said, well, you better call E Company so they know I'm not dead. So that's what they did. So that whole day was nothing but confusion.
And I want to talk about something you said there. You're going into the water, and you had to leave your machine gun behind. Mm-hmm. Now, this is supposed to be not just your protection, but protection for a whole bunch of your fellow soldiers.
Right.
So now you don't have that. You're coming ashore, and I imagine that there's enemy gunfire and artillery all around you, right?
Exactly. But, you know, there were so many weapons that were dropped by people who did get ashore, who were killed. If you needed a weapon, there it was on the beach because the person who was carrying it was probably killed. And there's another quick fact. In a division, there are 15,000 men, 9,000 of which were combatants, frontline troops. And my son, who's writing my biography, did his homework and discovered that the 29th Infantry Division suffered more casualties in World War II in that 11 months from June 44 till May 45 when the war was over. We had 20,000 casualties. Amazing.
That's a heavy number.
Yeah.
And for you, 19 years old, halfway around the world from home, getting shot at without what you were supposed to have to protect you, what in the world was going through your mind?
Well, like I said, fright, confusion, just you weren't thinking very straight, just to survive.
Now, this may sound like a dumb question, but I'm sure a lot of these young people are wondering themselves about it. Were you scared? Did you think that was it? Did you think you were going to see another day beyond June 6th?
No. I never thought I'd live to be 90, but there was a time when I didn't think I was going to live 10 more minutes. That's what war was like.
I believe it. And we look at now, and I'm just looking at your schedule of all the places around the country that you're going to be sharing your talents musically and thinking of all the lives that you've touched, much less your children and grandchildren. You even have great-grandchildren yet?
I do. I have 13 grandchildren and one great-grandchild.
And none of them would be here if you had been one of those guys from your division who didn't survive past that day.
Yeah.
And just to talk about some of your decorations in the war, and we're going to get to music, and it all ties together, and it's incredible the path that your life has taken. But you're a recipient two times over of the Bronze Star, which isn't easy to get. You earned the Combat Infantry Badge. If you guys ever see a veteran wearing a little blue rectangular badge with a rifle in the middle of it, that's a Combat Infantry Badge. You only earn that by being in combat, as Colonel Gabriel was. I'm sure you're not dying to talk about why you got this or why you got that, but from D-Day, that's just the beginning. I'm sure you had a whole lot of experience from that point on. What are some of the ones that stand out that remind you of how fortunate or blessed you are to still be around?
Well, I joined the 29th Infantry Division in Europe. As I said, they were there in 42. So I was a replacement. I trained in the United States as a BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle. When I got to the 29th, they said, no, you're going to be a machine gunner. Oh, really? So they trained me on a machine gun. And what they told me, this was absolutely true fact, that the life expectancy of a 30 caliber light machine gun in combat is 3 days. That's what I had to look forward to. And so when we went ashore on D-Day, like I said, we were supposed to take St. Lô, the first big major city in France, in 7 days, and it was the middle of July, so it was about 45 days before we took St. Lô. And then we went to the port of Brest, and the reason we went there, those of you who are history buffs, know that that's where the submarine bases were that scourged our fleets coming from the United States, troop ships and supply ships. And so by taking Brest, we would have silenced all of those submarines. But what we didn't realize is that they had a 240-millimeter cannon, huge. I mean, it was like a freight train when you heard one of those shells coming overhead. And they were trained, of course, into the ocean. But we didn't know that they turned 180 degrees on us. So that's what we faced in Brest.
I'm sure that giant German gun was a lot louder than that volley from John Philip Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever, but this music you're hearing right now is from a concert on the same stage where we conducted this interview with Colonel Gabriel conducting the Clovis North Wind Ensemble, String Orchestra, Symphony Orchestra, and even the choir from Granite Ridge Intermediate School. There were two concerts, both raising money for Central Valley Honor Flight and the mission of sending World War II veterans to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. We'll hear a little more of the music from those concerts throughout the program today, and we'll hear more of Colonel Gabriel's World War II experience when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a conversation with a 90-year-old who was just honored with the Air Force Exceptional Service Award, given only to those who demonstrate exceptional patriotism and service in a civilian capacity. A very active civilian conductor is what Arnold Gabriel has been since retiring as an Air Force colonel, having conducted the Air Force Band for more than 2,000 concerts all over the world. When we left off, though, this native of Cortland, New York, was describing his service as a World War II machine gunner with the 29th Infantry Division in Europe.
I met two men who were replacements for my machine gun squad, Harry Ashoff and Johnny Aerosmith, and they were with me for 3 months. Now, that's unusual. Like I said, the expectancy was 3 days, so we became very close. I knew all about their family. And on January 9th, 1945, the three of us were in a machine gun or in a foxhole, and we were hit by a German mortar, and both of them were killed. So they're buried in Margraten Cemetery in Netherlands. And they had their families were looking for somebody that knew their father in combat. So they wrote to the Army Records Section, they wrote to the Veterans Administration, they wrote to everybody they could think of. And then a few years ago, as you know, we built the World War II Memorial. And so I was a charter member. So they wrote to the World War II Memorial and said, is Harry Ashoff and Johnny Aerosmith, you know what, where they might be? Because they didn't even know where they were buried. And they said, oh, yes, they're members. And I said, how can that be? They were killed back in 45. Well, it was a Staff Sergeant Arnold Gabriel who signed them up as charter members. And that's how they found me. And so we had become very, very close. Harry Ashoff had a two-year-old son. And that two-year-old son came to Washington 4 years ago. And I gave them the tour, took him to World War II Memorial, and he's going to get his car to drive back to New Jersey. And he said, before I leave, he said, I want to ask you something. But before that, I want a hug. So he gave me a hug, and he said, will you be my dad? Mm.
That gets you.
Yeah.
I've talked to a lot of veterans who came home and met their first child for the first time at 3 or 4 years old because they'd been born while they were shipping off, or their wife was pregnant while they were shipping off. I've also met children who've had a lifelong quest, like your friend's son, to learn about their parents. So what you provided for him, holy moly, that's powerful. But there's another question that I have after hearing that story, and I bet some of you students are thinking the same thing. You said the three of you were all in the same foxhole, right?
Mm-hmm.
The mortar killed the two of them, but not you.
I was very lucky. I got a concussion and some bruises. I was authorized to get the Purple Heart, and I said, I can't get the Purple Heart. My two buddies were killed. I'm not going to get it for a few bruises, so I didn't get the Purple Heart.
I know this isn't easy to talk about again, but how do you deal with that? Again, you're still a young man, barely older than these kids at Clovis North High School here.
19 years old.
To have your two best friends who've been with you for months killed.
3 months, right. Yeah.
Not to mention what happened to you in the process. How do you process that and move on and continue to stay alive and fight the enemy?
Well, I didn't go right back to the front line. I stayed back with the kitchen unit, which was back in the rear area for 3-4 days until I regained my composure. My lieutenant gave me some advice, which is valuable for everybody in this room. I couldn't deal with reality. I couldn't deal about going back to the front line again. And Lieutenant Butler came to me and he said, I was still a private then. He said, Private Gabriel, he said, now you've got to get on your feet, you got to get back to the front line and put that all behind you. I said, yeah, but Lieutenant, do you remember St. Lo? Do you remember D-Day? He said, hold it right there. It's okay to look back, just don't stare. Great advice for everybody. Because we all have things in our lives that were traumatic, but we have to put those things behind us and move on. And that's what I did.
Were you still over in Europe when VE Day came?
Yes, on VE Day, I was up on the Elbe River where we met the Russians. Those of you who are history buffs know that Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt met at Yalta to determine what was going to happen with Europe when the war was over. And we were not allowed to go beyond the Elbe River. And that's why there was East and West Germany after the war. So we met the Russians. But before we met the Russians, thousands of Germans came across the Elbe River to surrender to us, rather than surrender to the Russians, because they knew what would happen if they surrendered to the Russians.
When you heard the news that Germany had surrendered, was there some sense of satisfaction?
Well, to a degree, because the 29th was going to go back and march down Fifth Avenue, but I didn't have enough points because I didn't go over with them in 42. So my only concern was, am I going to be sent to the South Pacific to go to another war? Yeah. And I had had it. But I stayed in the Army of Occupation.
One thing I guess I should ask you, in light of what you've been doing since World War II, was there ever a time while you were over there as a soldier with the 29th that you got to channel some of that stress and angst and terror through music and find some relaxation through your joy of music?
Absolutely. After the war was over, I was very confused. I was still only 20 years old when I was separated, and I had the war behind me at 20 years old. And I worked in a factory for 67 cents a day in a warehouse. And the reason I did that is because I wanted to be alone. I didn't want anybody to bother me. And my high school band director came to that factory, and he said, "Arnold, what are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm making a living." He said, "You're going to college." I said, "I can't go to college. How can I compete with students like you, right out of high school who are playing their instruments?" I hadn't played anything but a machine gun for 3 years, and people who had played in military bands for 3 or 4 years. I can't compete with them. He said, "You're going to college." He insisted. So he went to Ithaca College, which is his alma mater, paid my matriculation fee, waived my audition, literally pushed me into college. And he also went to the band director and the orchestra director and said, "Put this young boy in the first chair." Well, I knew I didn't deserve that. So I said, "Okay, I'll try it for a semester." And I did practice 3 and 4 hours a day so I wouldn't disappoint him or me. I figured out that the only way I was going to get through the war was to keep busy. And to this day, you know my schedule. There is no time for me to think about the war except for times like this. So when I was in college, when I was a sophomore, there was a vacancy for a choir director at a Baptist church, even though I was Catholic, in Cortland, New York. And I went to the pastor and I said, "I would like to apply for the job." He said, "Have you ever conducted choirs?" I said, "Oh, sure." Never had. And the Syracuse Drum and Bugle Corps, they were looking for directors. "Have you ever conducted a drum corps?" "Sure." Never had. I don't know if you know the name Patrick Conway. He was a famous band director along with Sousa and so forth. He was from Homer, New York, by the way, mm-hmm. and also conducted a band there. So I went to the mayor, and now I'm still a sophomore in college. I said, "You know, Patrick Conway used to have a band. Where's all that music and instruments and so forth?" "Oh, they're in the basement of City Hall." I said, "What do you think about starting the band again?" He said, "Well, we need a conductor." And I said, "I can do that." He said, "Have you ever conducted a band?" "Oh, yes." Never had.
You're sounding a lot more like Harold Hill here as you keep going. You guys ever seen The Music Man? No? He just makes it all up as he goes.
But there's a point to all of this. People say, how do you get conducting experiences? You make your own experiences. And that's true of anything. Nobody's going to come to you and say, "Hey, you want a great job?" You have to go out and get it. And that's what I did. And of course, and then on Friday and Saturday, I played in a dance band. So I worked every single night of the week, played first chair in the band and the orchestra, graduated cum laude, the honor, senior honor society. I don't know how I did all of that, but kept very busy. When the Korean War came about, I decided, well, I'm not going to go back to the infantry. And I knew that the Air Force was looking for band directors, so in 1951, I applied for a job as a band director in the Air Force and was accepted. And the same thing happened. I kept extremely busy by always doing more than was expected of me. Not so much that I thought it was necessary for my mission, but it was more for me to keep busy than anything else. And of course, I've many, many stories about my experiences in Germany and the Air Force Band in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about some of that. And I'm mindful of that advice that was shared with you, that you shared with all of us, that it's okay to look back, just don't stare. And I don't want to make you stare. But I'm also thinking about these young people who weren't alive in World War II and might not understand some of the conditions you battled. And I know the Germans were awful. You talked about that 240-millimeter gun from Brest, and those 88s were everywhere. I'm sure you had nightmares about them. But what about, aside from the enemy, what were the worst conditions or just obstacles of surviving day to day, whether anyone was shooting at you or not, that you had to overcome?
Well, that winter of 1944-45 in Germany was the worst winter they had had that for the entire century. We were out in foxholes in sub-zero weather every single night and all day long. And you can imagine trying to bear up under the weather conditions, to say nothing about fighting a war. and we were at the north flank of the Battle of the Bulge, which occurred in December of 44. So that was an extremely difficult time. People had frostbite on their fingers and their toes and lost limbs just because of being out in the cold. And penicillin was just developed then, and of course we all had colds, and I go back to the battalion aid station because I had this terrible cold, and they give me penicillin. And every time you did anything, more penicillin. Rolled the calendar forward, I had some dental work done in 1958. The penicillin almost killed me because I had taken so much of it. I became immune to it. I OD'd on it, literally, so I'm allergic to penicillin. But that winter, to answer your question, that was a brutal winter, just not because of the war so much as the weather. There's another story I want to tell you very quickly. The 30 caliber light machine gun, every fifth round is a tracer. You know what a tracer is? It's a bullet that you can see. And the reason for that is you can see where your bullets are landing, right? But conversely, they can see where they're coming from, too. So they can zero in on you. So that's why you dig a lot of foxholes. Keep moving. I learned that another expression I use. You can't hit a moving target. So I keep moving.
They haven't got you yet. So the weather was tough, and sleeping at night without a whole lot of warmth in a frozen foxhole sounds like a picnic. But I'm sure you always had a hot meal no matter where you went, right? The food must have been great.
No, C rations and K rations.
Tell all these young people what those are.
Well, K ration is, it looks like a Cracker Jack box. And I had a little can of either eggs or ham or something. And you had a little can opener on your dog tag, and you'd open up, and that was your meal, period. And everybody smoked in those days. As a matter of fact, we had six cigarettes in K-rations, and I never smoked a cigarette in my life. And my son again said, Dad, in World War II, everybody smoked, but you didn't. And I never did, and I never have. And if you do, stop now.
And before I move on to more of your musical exploits, obviously D-Day, anyone that was where you were when you were on D-Day, that's a pretty close call just by being there and living through it. When you talk about being in the foxhole and two of your buddies are killed and you survive, were there any other moments that you look back on and say, yeah, that was a really close call, that could have been me?
Well, several. And some of these will be in the book, and they're not so gory that I can't tell them. When we got into Germany, there were an awful lot of little farm villages, and really not villages, a group of maybe 8 or 10 homes and farms clustered around one little area. And we were tasked to take several of those when we got into Germany. And it was very difficult because they had dug in very, very deeply, because that's where the Siegfried Line was. A whole series of dragon teeth, which are concrete barriers about that tall to prevent tanks from going in. But anyway, I remember going across one of those fields because we figured that farmhouse now had been vacated. And as I walked across the field and pushed back the bushes, I was looking in the face of an 88-millimeter cannon. Fortunately, nobody was behind it.
Holy
you
moly.
Talk about a close call. And by the way, nobody in this room knows a comedy team in World War II called Olsen and Johnson. You know the name?
I've heard of them.
Remember the name of the show?
No.
Hell's a-Poppin'.
That's right.
That was the name of my machine gun. Hell's a-Poppin'. I thought a very appropriate name. And the reason I bring that up is because another close call. I'm in the foxhole, and my two buddies went back to the kitchen area there was an opportunity to get a hot meal. So I was there alone. Things were pretty quiet. And I'll keep this clean. I had to go to the bathroom. So rather than go in the foxhole, I went to behind a tree. And when I got back to the foxhole, a mortar shell had hit it and destroyed Hell's a-Poppin'. That's how close I came. So it's things like that, what might have happened, that really scare you to death.
So the lesson there is, when you have to go, you better go? Saved your life.
Yeah, it did.
I guess another question, and maybe sometimes I forget to ask the basic question. For all of us here who weren't alive back then, why was it so important for you to do what you were doing? Did you understand what the mission was, what the goal was, what the great importance of your cause was?
Well, it was a different kind of war than we're having now in the Middle East, because we had a common enemy. It was Hitler and Tojo, and the entire country was behind it. There was no dissension about not going to war or going to war. Everybody was behind it. So when you're up there on the front line and you're looking at your buddies, they got my back, so I better get their back.
Obviously, America's freedom was at stake. America had been attacked. The freedom of the whole world was at stake. Mm-hmm. I imagine you probably still had relatives in Italy, too.
I did. Yes, I did.
And their freedom was at stake.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And what you and 16 million other Americans helped to do changed the world for all of them. Another thing, do you remember when you first learned of the existence of these concentration camps throughout Europe?
Yeah, we came across one, and I don't think it had a name because there were several of them. And there were many Italians. I spoke enough Italian, so I was the interpreter. And this is just an aside. They were talking to me, and I'd say, yeah, yeah, yeah. And they said, no, yeah, yeah, e that's German. See, see. They say, see is Italian, not yeah, that's German.
Was the horror of that camp and those camps in general something that was almost too big to fathom at that point, or did you get a grasp of it?
No, I never did get a grasp of it. I still shudder when I think about it and some of the things that I saw. Just indescribable. Mm.
So many of Colonel Gabriel's World War II memories are sobering. As we head toward another break, listening to some more of that concert he conducted in Clovis, California, I'll remind you to check out photos of the Colonel at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Radio Facebook page. When we come back, we're going to explore how music has helped bring healing and also provided the vehicle for the adventure of a lifetime. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Enjoying some music today from one of the thousands of concerts our guest has conducted over the years. Thanks again to Clovis North High School in Clovis, California, specifically Arthur Hawansky, David Lesser, and their principal, Scott Dilley, for arranging this interview in front of an audience of high school and junior high students. We've heard about how Arnold Gabriel, the son of Italian immigrants, became a machine gunner with the 29th Infantry Division, came ashore on Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944. We've heard what he survived as the division pushed across Europe, and he's been pretty candid about how difficult it all was. But his perspective grew when he got to return to Europe more than a decade after World War II as an Air Force band leader. How do you think you'd react to this order from your commanding general?
He said, "Captain, first thing I want you to do is improve relations between the United States and Germany." And I'm thinking, you know, only 13 years ago we were shooting at each other. I got to improve relations. I said, "Yes, sir." So we did several things. And to show you how music can really heal, I did an American musical every year for those 5 years with Germans and Americans at the German-American Club. So on stage here were Germans and Americans singing and dancing. Now, in the pit, I needed an orchestra. I didn't have an orchestra. I had a band, no strings. But in those days, and I still think they still do, the Bundeswehr band from Bonn, which is their national band, would come out and play a band concert. In the second half, they all doubled on strings. They come out and play the Beethoven Fifth, same people, doubling on strings. So I went to my commanding general, who said, "Improve relations," asked him to go. I couldn't do it. Went to the Bundeswehr and asked for their string section. So I had Americans and Germans in the pit, in the orchestra, and on the stage. And we did Kiss Me, Kate, and Paint Your Wagon, and Brigadoon every year. We had a hall of about 1,000 people, 8 nights sold out every single night. What music can really do is to bring people together. It was very, very, very successful.
And how else are you ever going to hear Paint Your Wagon in a German accent? Right?
Exactly, yeah.
Hear this musical career that started in earnest, I guess, about 65 years ago, has taken you literally just about everywhere, right? What are some of the highlights as far as the parts of the world that you've experienced or the places you've been that you wouldn't have been without music?
Well, there's one story I tell kind of facetiously, but it's true, some of the highlights. One of the great highlights was conducting the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, and I don't know whether you're too young to remember Donny Osmond. He was my soloist who sang The Last Full Measure of Devotion. 340 voices and 80-piece symphony orchestra. That certainly had to be a highlight.
And that Last Full Measure of Devotion, that's a quote that originated with President Lincoln during the Civil War, talking about someone who gives his life in the service of our country.
Right.
When you're conducting something like that, whether it's singing or just a great piece of music, do you ever find yourself, even though you've done it thousands of times, feeling that emotion that so many of us feel when we're listening to it?
It's always with me. At the beach of Normandy, we did Hymn to the Fallen from Saving Private Ryan. Not only was I bawling, but half the band was bawling too.
Let's talk about that, the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Tell all of us where you were, what you were doing, and who you had with you.
We were sponsored by Music Celebrations out of Phoenix, and they formed 110 players from all over the United States. I think we had about 20 from Clovis in that band.
The Clovis Community Band, exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we had 110, and we had rehearsals in Paris, and on the 4th of Paris, we did a concert at City Hall in Paris, and then on D-Day, June 6th, on Omaha Beach, and played a concert there. Again, it was very, very emotional. And somebody counted, we played, I think, 9 selections, and we had 8 standing ovations.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was the audience like?
Well, they came from all over that Normandy area. And the little old ladies that were alive in World War II, not many men were because they were either killed or died since, come up and kiss me on both cheeks with tears in their eyes because I'm still, to them, a liberator.
You are. And if we were all to go there right now, there are a lot of things that we could see. I mean, we could see that same beach that they came ashore. You could even see some of the military equipment that was there at the time. You could see the little church in St. Mary Glees with a paratrooper still hanging from it just as he was that day when John Steele got hung up on the steeple. There are a lot of things that we could see that remind us of it, but we weren't there. and you were. And here on a day, the 70th anniversary, when the President of the United States and all these other world leaders are there, you're there conducting a band, not just as something that's interesting to you, but something that you lived and something that killed your friends. What did that feel like to be in that spot at that moment doing what you were doing?
Well, the President of France was also there, along with the President Obama. And on YouTube, you can see the President giving the speech at the military cemetery where 9,600 people who died at Normandy are buried. And I'm sitting directly behind the President. When he finishes his speech, he turned around and shook hands with, there were only about, I think, 20 or 30 veterans of D-Day who were there. And both presidents shook hands with me, and that's on YouTube. That, again, very, very moving.
I know you don't stare when you look back. You made that clear to us, and I'm going to remember that. That's a powerful statement. But do you ever look back and say, why me? How did this all work out the way it did for me? Why am I the one that survived all of this, that has had all these opportunities, and here I am all these years later still going and having the privilege of honoring all those guys who aren't still here?
Well, yeah, there's almost a feeling of guilt. But on the other hand, I feel like I have to continue to give, that my life was spared, and as long as I can continue to give, I'm going to. And I have 3 contracts to conduct when I'm 100 years old, and I'm going to do it, by the way.
You have 3 contracts?
Yes, I do.
You've committed to it?
Yes.
You can't back out?
Nope.
I don't want to put any words in your mouth. I'm just always interested to understand how you understand it and how you grasp it. And I think it's kind of funny that here you told us you're a Catholic, but your first music job was in a Baptist church. You've conducted the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. You've done these things. Just music has bridged every possible divide.
And then I worked with the Tokyo Kasai, and Kasai is Buddhist. So all of our rehearsals were in a Buddhist temple, so you take your shoes off.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of stories there, but I'll move on. And when I was in Europe, I worked in Tehran, which was the center of Islam in those days.
Yeah.
And as you know, on my website, there's a picture of me and Pope John II, who's Catholic. So the Buddhists, the Mormons, the Islam, and Catholic. So when I go to heaven, I've touched all bases.
Well, maybe that answers my question, which was just...
Those are 4 of the highlights, by the way.
Yeah, and it's incredible. Very few people could have pulled that off. So I guess that's my question. What is your explanation for that? Do you believe that someone was pulling those strings for you? Do you think that's just the way it happened? You're the one who lived it, so what's your perspective?
Well, there's another old expression, there are no atheists in the foxhole.
Yeah, and you spent a lot of time in a foxhole.
Yeah, so you become a believer.
One of the questions here that the students came up with was about patriotic music and how it's changed over the years. I guess maybe that's a question I have is, how would you define what patriotic music is? What are the characteristics of a composition that makes you proud to be an American?
When I was in Europe, we had 5 bands, and I was command band supervisor of all 5 bands. I was there in Germany. We had another band in Ramstein, Germany, 1 in London, 1 in Libya, and 1 in Madrid. The European bands had 100 players. I only had 60. So I would combine about 3 of those bands, so I had at least 100. When we played Bari, Italy, you have to understand that southern Italy is very communistic. In the center of communism was Bari. So we marched down the field and were booed by 40,000 Italians. And then we played Irving Berlin, Glenn Miller, Leonard Bernstein, all of the great American composers. 15 minutes later, 40,000 Italians were standing on their feet cheering. That's the power of music. We probably didn't change their politics, but I certainly made an inroad, I think, about what they thought about Americans.
I've heard that so many times. Music is the universal language. Mm-hmm. It sounds like your life is a testament to that.
There's several stories, but another I would like to tell. February 1945, we crossed the Ruhr River, not the R-U-H-R, R-O-U-M-L-O-T-E-R River. And that was the most important river in Germany, because the Rhine River, the Germans had left the Remagen Bridge open. They had planted bombs in it, but they never set them off. So the Americans we drove trucks and tanks across the Rhine River without a problem. But the Ruhr River was something else. We crossed the Ruhr River in February and fought for 7 days to take the little town of Jülich across the river. And our commanding general said, you know, there's a city of Mönchengladbach, a third of a million people. If we take that, with the largest city we will have taken in Germany to date, we'll make headlines. So we marched, after fighting for 7 days, marched all night long, 20 kilometers, attacked Mönchengladbach the next morning. About 10 days later, finally took Mönchengladbach. Now that's tired. Never having been to bed. Wow. So move the clock forward. Now I'm command band director in Wiesbaden, Germany. We were asked to play a marching festival in Mönchengladbach. I said, I remember that city. So again, five bands, one from Egypt that played the triumphal march from Aida with costumes like from the opera, with a herald trumpet. Really, really terrific. And they had a band from Denmark and one from Norway and so forth. And we were last, and we did our typical American show with all of the American patriotic music. Glenn Miller, they love Glenn Miller. And after the show was over, the Burgomeister, the mayor of Mönchengladbach, invited all of the bands to the Ratskeller, the city hall. And here was about 300 musicians sitting for dinner. And I was sitting with my band, and the mayor of Mönchengladbach comes up, kind of looking kind of sheepishly, and he approached me and he said, Captain, you know, this festival was not a contest, but we all felt that the American band was the best, and we wanted to present you with a city flag of Mönchengladbach. Think about the irony of that story. So I got back to Wiesbaden, Germany, and the Stars and Stripes is the official newspaper for overseas troops. And the headline of the Stars and Stripes says, Gabriel captures Mönchengladbach in war and with music. What a great headline.
And probably both equally as satisfying.
Especially with music.
Yeah, I believe it. I'm looking at some of the other questions that these young people have come up with, and I bet you've got a dozen answers for this one, too. Somebody wanted to know, who were your favorite guest soloists with the Air Force Band, and why?
Well, if you don't know Dan Asmo, you probably wouldn't know the others. Maybe you do. If you watch the late movies, you probably watched Edward G. Robinson, Shirley Temple. Anybody know Shirley Temple? She was a very dear friend. She appeared with me several times. There was a television show, I'm sure Paul remembers, the Mike Douglas Show from Philadelphia, and he always had a co-host. And when Shirley Temple was the co-host, she always had the Air Force Band come along to appear, and she did a narration with us. We won the Freedom's Foundation Medal for the most patriotic show of the year. So we were asked to repeat it in front of Independence Hall in Philadelphia the following year. And I have a videotape of that, a CD of it. It's terrific.
Mm, I've got to check that out.
But she's one of my favorites. And Doc Severance, and nobody remembers him probably either.
From The Tonight Show?
She had The Tonight Show before. Well, I don't know who has it now.
There was another name that I saw had some really good things to say about you, a legendary musician, Dave Brubeck. I actually interviewed a veteran who served with Dave Brubeck during the war. What was your interaction with him?
Well, again, we did several shows together. And he brought his sons. It was Dave Brubeck and his three boys. And when we did our Constitution Hall series, we had 4,000 people. We had a rehearsal from 1 to 2, opened their doors at 2, concert at 3, that fast. But before the guest came, I always wanted to know what they were going to do. And if I had a recording, I wanted that recording so I knew the tempos, so the rehearsals would go very, very well. I always wanted to be prepared. So he sent me tapes of what he was going to do, and we did the rehearsal. I said, anything more? He said, why don't we do an encore? I said, Dave, we don't have an encore. He said, I'll write one. So between 2 and 3, by the time that he had written a lead sheet, gave it to my arranger, and my arranger's backstage arranging your full concert band. And during the concert, the parts are going under the stand. And so it was take 5, by the way, so everybody knew it pretty well. If you go to my website, which is very easy, colgabriel.com, there's a section that's called Critical Acclaim that my public relations guy put together with quotes from some of these guest artists that were with me. And his quote is priceless. It said, your rehearsal was like a concert, and your concert was a celebration. One of the best quotes I've ever had.
Hard to beat that. You've conducted in all 50 states, 50-plus countries around the world. Is there something that in almost 90 years you haven't done yet that you're still hoping to do someday?
Not really, just keep on moving.
He's doing a pretty good job of that, isn't he? Yeah. We've got a couple minutes left here. Before I forget, I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country in war and through music for all these years, because the impact that you've had in music is incredibly significant for so many people. So thank you for all of that, and thank you for taking the time to tell us some of this today. You mentioned the book that your son is working on.
Mm-hmm.
Any clue when that's going to be available?
He thinks he can finish it this year.
If that book turns into a movie, who do you think should play Colonel Gabriel?
Me. You see, that's optimism.
Is that one of those three contracts you have for when you're 100? What about the 19-year-old PFC Gabriel at Omaha Beach? Who would play him?
Probably one of my grandchildren.
Perfect. I like your answers.
With all the looking back we've done, he's given us something to look forward to as well, hasn't he? Our radio time is running out for today. You'll find a little more of the interview and a little more music in the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks again to Clovis North High School for the venue, the audience, and most importantly, the chance to record this interview to share with you. One thing Arnold Gabriel learned as a teenager in combat and through his actions in all the decades since has helped countless others come to understand: America is worth celebrating, and freedom is not free.
You go back into the service after college, you decide on the Air Force, and we left this out earlier. Before you ended up in the Army, you actually wanted to be a pilot, right?
Well, that's right. Well, I had a very checkered career. I started out in the Army in 43 in the anti-aircraft, 450 caliber machine guns and a half track, and that's a death trap because you're wide open to anything that flies. And so I had a friend who said, I'm going to go fly airplanes, because the Army Air Corps was a part of the Army. So I went with him and took pilot training at the University of Buffalo, where we flew all of the light aircraft, Piper Cubs and so forth. And then it was early in 44 where the Department of Defense decided, well, everybody that had been in the ground forces are going back to the ground forces because they knew D-Day was coming. So I ended up worse off than I started, because I started out in the anti-aircraft and ended up with the infantry. So 44,000 of us washed out at the convenience of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And then very stupidly, after 1 month of infantry training, I volunteered for overseas and joined the 29th Infantry Division.
What possessed you to do that?
Because I didn't like training with the infantry. Ended up worse than I thought I was going to.
Yeah. Yet you're still here through it all. After you came home, you went to college, then you joined the Air Force, which was actually the Air Force by then. Were you thinking about flying again, or did you know music is going to be my military path?
No, military was going to be my profession. I concentrated on that. But I did the same thing as I did in college. I did all kinds of other things that I wasn't supposed to do. when I was at Sampson Air Force Base, which is a training center, just train people to come into the service, you know, who to salute and what to paint and so forth. But I did a radio broadcast over 520 stations over what was then the Mutual Broadcasting System. I had a young fellow that came through with a clarinet, the worst clarinet player I ever heard. But he was a New York producer. And I said, I'm going to hire this guy. So he produced his radio shows. So, and that was very successful. We did that for 2 years. And so we weren't supposed to do this, but always did something that beyond what I was expected of me. And I did the same thing when I was at Langley. I had the drum and bugle corps. I had a concert band. I conducted the, believe it or not, a nun's choir. And then I went overseas and did the same thing there. We just traveled. When I got to Germany, we played constantly in 24 countries of Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, including Tehran, which was then, of course, very pro-American, because the Shah of Iran was very pro-American.
And you're talking about that, and you describe the initiative that you took in all these situations. And I'm just wondering, you know, usually when I'm talking to a veteran, I'm going to end up asking them at some point, because a little aside, I'll tell you the story. My grandfather was in Europe in the war. In fact, he was in a lot of the places you talked about, St. Lo and Brest and the Bulge. He was in the Medical Corps, and he got a Silver Star for pulling 26 guys out of burning tanks. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the first veterans I interviewed, and I said, well, when you went in to rescue those guys and everyone else was getting the heck out of there, what were you thinking? And he looked at me and he said, well, I thought I was going to get killed. And I said, I'm glad you didn't. And he said, yeah, you wouldn't be around. And you know, that's so true for so many of us. We might never have been born. And usually that's what I talk about with veterans, so your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids. But I'm thinking of probably just as important a moment for you when that high school teacher came back around and told you, this is what you're going to do. In other words, I believe in you. You can do this.
Right.
I imagine all that initiative you just described with your career in music probably wouldn't have happened without his spark.
Well, and coincidentally, the factory that I was working for went bankrupt a year after I left. That's the sequel to that story.
Timing is everything. Has there ever been a tension for you between conducting and composition? Because I'm sure a lot of these young musicians, they're saying, what am I going to do in the world of music? And they're plotting their future and dreaming about different things they can do. And maybe some of them really get that rush of conducting, but others are more in the line of composing and coming up with original work. How much time have you spent over the years working on maybe producing original material?
I just have never had the time, and I don't think they would be very good. I probably could do it. But it's, unless it's very good, I wouldn't want to do it.
Nothing but the best.
I have plenty to do with my conducting. As you probably know, if you go on, again, my website, you'll see I do about 22 or 24 jobs a year. So it keeps me very, very busy. And I have 13 grandchildren to look after as well.
Where does all the energy come from? What's your secret?
I don't know. Probably pick the right parents. I think it's in the genes.
I'm glad I married an Italian then. Do you have a favorite patriotic piece? Is there one that makes you swell up with pride or emotion more than some others?
Not really. Last Full Measure of Devotion, Saving Private Ryan, the Hymn to the Fallen, God Bless America.
You've given these young people a lot of advice just as part of your story today, and hopefully they were listening and heard some of those nuggets that you shared. But when someone comes to you and says, you know, I don't know exactly what I want to do, but I really want to pursue music as a career, what's the most central piece of advice you'd like to share with them?
Well, it's never going to be easy. Music has never been easy in the history of the world. As you probably know, years and years ago, music was centered in the church, pretty much. The Gregorian chants began there, the organist and so forth. But for it to exist outside on its own, it's always been difficult, especially now. Symphony orchestras are drying up or reducing in numbers. Opera companies and ballet companies are going out of business. But don't ever give up. If music is your dream, there'll be a place for you. Make your own opportunity. And don't ever forget what your high school band director, orchestra, and choir director did for you. They have given you a wonderful opportunity. This school has a wonderful reputation, and you should be very proud of it.
Amen to that. You know, it strikes me that there are a lot of things you've done in your life and you're not trying to draw attention to that. You're not puffing out your chest, even though you've got enough medals to fill that chest. But what are you most proud of? What gives you the most satisfaction now when you do take the time to kind of reflect on your life's journey?
Well, I think the most important thing in my life is my family, what they've given me and the support they've given me. When they were growing up, I wasn't home very much. I told you I was on the road almost constantly, and they turned out beautifully. I'm so proud of my children. They never got in any kind of trouble at all. All of them have wonderful jobs. My oldest boy, who writing my book, just retired from American Airlines as a pilot after 36 years, and did all of this on their own, by the way, without any help from me. But I'm so proud of them. That's my biggest pride in life, is my family. But I was going to tell the story about the two young folks who had questions. I could barely hear you. It reminds me of a story. I was doing a clinic in Texas. We quit about 10 or 15 minutes early, and the band director said, "Would you do a Q&A with the band?" I said, "Sure." I answered a few questions, and a percussion in the band asked me a question, and I couldn't hear him. I said, "Would you repeat that, please?" And he asked it again. I still couldn't hear him. So I asked the flute player in the front row. I said, "What did he say?" He said, "Did combat affect your hearing?" And I think he set me up. He said, "It's just loud enough for the band to hear it."
Well, Colonel, again, I just want to say thank you. And thank you to Clovis North for making this possible. What a privilege for all of us. Is there anything else that you want us to know? Hold on a second. Didn't you guys hear him say that at Normandy, of the 9 pieces he played, he got 8 standing ovations? What do you think we should do for Colonel Gabriel right now, huh? I want to give you the last word if you want it.
Love music, love your music teacher, love your family.
Can't get any better than that. Thank you, guys. You've been great. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Outstanding.
The United States Army. States Navy. Force.